So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar, and this week I'm joined by Deputy Editor Nate Ingram. Hey, Nate.
Hey, Dev. How's it going?
It's going good. We're going to be talking about Apple. There's a bunch of stuff we didn't get to talk about last week because, there's so many things we can review at once, so I will be diving into the Apple Studio display. Nate reviewed the iPad Air. We've got a bunch of news to dive into and a fun Ask Engadget question, so stick around for all of that. And stay tuned to the end of this episode for our interview with Dan Erickson, the creator of Severance on Apple TV+. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to the Engadget Podcast on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes or, you know, whatever platforms, but iTunes is the best. And you can drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. We typically do a live stream of the show on Thursdays around 10 a.m. Eastern, so you can join us on our YouTube channel for that. You know, join the chat. Talk with us. You can see some behind-the-scenes action. We do some Q&A, and occasionally we'll show off some gear. Let's talk about the Studio Display. Apple's Studio Display. I have so many feelings about this, Nate, and you are more of a Mac head than I am, so my review is up. My review's title is Apple Studio Display for Mac-loving eyes only. It's the best Apple monitor for consumers, unfortunately. So I've got issues. Like, I think it is a nice-looking 5K panel. You know, it is a well-designed screen. It is kind of your only option for a sub-$5,000 Apple-approved, Apple-made display, which can go really nicely with the new Mac Studio, which I really liked last week. Be sure to check out our episode and discussion about that. But this feels like a display that was made 5 or 6 years ago. Right, it is basically the same screen that was in the 5K iMac from 2014. It's a little brighter; it's 100 nits brighter, I believe. But otherwise, like, the panel tech is the same, the resolution is the same. I don't even need resolution; I just want, like, better panel tech. This is an IPS LCD, which is fine, but it has a single backlight. There's no, like, local dimming zones like you'd find on modern TVs or any other modern monitor. There's certainly no mini LED support, which is the really cool technology that we saw on the new MacBook Pros. And I think that's on the Pro XDR screen, too.
It's on the iPad Pro, too.
Yeah, it's on the iPad Pro. So let me just talk about that, because backlighting is important.
You care about this more than most people, I feel like,
too. Everybody should care about this. This is the entire point. This is why you buy a new TV, okay?
More so than resolution.
Before I get too deep into that, Nate, like, you saw my review. You've seen, like, the general consensus on this. As somebody who likes Mac hardware, like, what is your overall takeaway on this monitor?
I think that, like, your headline hits the nail on the head. It's for Mac fans. I am a Mac fan. I typically use Macs for all personal and work stuff. So I'm, like, in the target audience, and the simplicity and feature set is very cool, but the price is out of whack with the quality display you get.
Yeah.
Like, so you
recognize
bucks.
That. You recognize
I do. Absolutely, I do.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I remember the old, like, Apple used to sell a 27-inch Thunderbolt display that was similarly, like, nice, like, one plug. It had a built-in charger for your laptop. It was like the 27-inch iMac at the time, which I think was a quad HD screen, which is pretty nice for the early 2010s. It was about like $800, I think. So still expensive compared to other, like, similar panels, but not, you know, twice as much as this, you know, this display is. So even as somebody who loves Mac hardware and can see the benefits of this, I wouldn't buy it. And if I'm not going to buy it, I don't know who will.
So you like Mac hardware, but not enough to, like, pay. This is truly an Apple tax device where you're paying a lot more money compared to what's on the market right now, just for Apple niceties, basically. And this is what's really confounding to me, right? This thing starts at $1,599. If you want the nano texture glass, right? Where's the additional price for that? That's $300. If you want a height adjustable display, the ability to move the monitor up and down, $400. So if you want all of those things put together, that's a $2,300 monitor. That's insane to me for what you get with this thing. There are some cool new features, like it has an A13 processor. It has a built-in webcam, which is not that great, but at least it's built in. It has a really nice speaker system, and we'll talk more about like what that A13 processor means. But as a screen, guys, as a thing you look at all day, it looks nice objectively. But I was talking about the backlighting thing. Older LCD screens, older TVs from like 10 years ago had like a single backlight, right? It was either on or off, and that was fine, but it wasn't great for like black levels and contrast. And you really see that here, where the darkest black you can get from the screen is like a gray, like a inky gray. It's really noticeable too, because the entire like large bezel around this monitor is pure black. So you can see
there's where a there's contrast under. Between the yeah. two. Yeah.
And it's not great. It's not great at all. So by adding more local dimming zones and basically more zones of backlights throughout screens, that's how TV makers and monitor makers have been able to like localize that brightness. So for a sunset or something, you can put a little more bright stuff there so you don't have to blow up the whole screen and kind of like put everything out of wax. That's what enables HDR, you know, on newer 4K TVs. That's what gets you like that nice, realistic looking lighting. There's none of that here. It's just a single backlight zone. So it just feels ancient in a way. And it's weird because Apple has really spoiled us, I think, with a lot of the new Retina displays. Like I upgraded to the iPhone 13 Pro. I want the Pro Motion. I wanted a higher refresh rate. That's not on this screen. It's still stuck at 60 Hertz. So perfectly fine. But if you do a lot of scrolling, you will notice it is not as smooth as other things. Is that something you care at all about, Nate?
So I think that you're getting into an interesting place here, because I think that the people that this monitor will appeal to are people who aren't quite as like you're very, very hardcore in terms of your like visual fidelity knowledge, and you know, you appreciate
I don't think
this
you
stuff.
Have to be. I think like
no, you, what do, I'm you saying, don't. Yeah. You don't. But I think that the people who would be interested in this monitor are more interested in it being this all-in-one solution with these features that complement their Mac really nicely, and that's fine. But like, you know, and so I'd agree that like things like fast refresh rates, you know, and HDR, I mean, maybe less of an HDR thing. Like obviously this monitor isn't meant for gaming, and that's fine. I wouldn't have expected it to be.
It's meant for movie production. It's meant for video production.
That's and the other thing I was going to say.
HDR is like essential these days. Yeah.
Yeah. Like it's the kind of thing that like somebody who bought like the entry level MacBook Pro, the 14-inch model, they spent $2,000 on a nice laptop and they want a really nice display to pair with it. Like that's the market there. But I feel like they like really shot themselves in the foot in terms of like pairing this thing with the Mac Studio, which is obviously a super powerful, super compelling desktop computer. And it needs a monitor to like match that. And this just doesn't seem to be it. If you're, like you said, a professional working on video production, that sort of thing. Like none of my work is color sensitive, right? I do photography. I like it to look good, but you know, I'm not like making movies here. So that's why I'm like, oh, this would probably be a fine display for me, but I'm not going to spend $1,600 on just fine when I can spend $800 on this, like this delightful 32-inch Dell, you know, 4K screen that like looks great and I think has HDR and, you know, so forth. So
it's confounding. Like the market, like maybe they're like, okay, if you're a real professional, you're going to spend $6,000 and get the Pro XDR 6K screen, which is a beautiful like 32-inch monitor. But yeah, I think that's out of reach for a lot of like people who aren't working in like production houses or something. I think it's more the imbalance between like what Apple has been putting in a lot of their devices, their Pro devices. It feels really weird to be looking at the screen and seeing the price they're charging, seeing the extra fee for just height adjustability, which is a basic feature. Like Dell offers it on all of their, pretty much all of their monitors, even their like cheap $200 to $300 monitors. So that's not like something you should pay extra for. If you want to change the stand down the line, by the way, you can't. So if like you change your mind, you just want to like physically mount this studio display, you can't remove the stand. So you have to choose the base mount option from the start.
Really?
You have to choose the height adjustable option from the start. That is ridiculous too, because people's workflows change all the time.
Right. You move. You want a new setup.
You move. Yeah. You get a new desk. You want to like get a monitor arm or something. So that is really where my criticisms come in. I see a lot of like much harsher reviews of this thing. So I'm not even being like completely negative here. Like, I think for if you're an Apple head and you don't care about what you're missing here, which is a shame because I think Apple should treat you better because you are the loyal customers, then you'll probably be fine. But it really grinds my gears when I see this happening. And to me, this is even more annoying than the like $1,000 stand for the Pro Display, because those people will pay whatever. Those expenses are expense to their companies. You know, it's not a personal price. But this is a monitor meant for normal people to buy and to put on their desk and to put beside the Mac Studio. And it is just not as good. Like right now, I'm looking at Alienware's QD OLED 34-inch ultra-wide monitor. This thing, it's a beast. It is like the best gaming monitor you can get. It has a 175 hertz refresh rate. It has 1,000 nits of peak brightness. It has actual HDR. It has OLED, so that means pixels.
I'm getting excited.
$1,299.
All right.
It's expensive, but it's not $1,699. It's not $2,300, and it is a much more useful monitor. Dell has other things, too, for like artists and video professionals. I reviewed the 40-inch ultra wide, which is I believe under 2000. I gotta double check that pricing, but that's a bigger screen, also has the same like color accuracy as the Studio Display, and just like more modern, better backlights. So basically I'm really annoyed with what Apple did here, and it feels like they don't understand, like they don't care what is happening in the rest of the market, and it really annoys me. That probably comes across in my review, but I hope I was fair there. Do you have any other thoughts on this thing?
I think it's very much coming across right now, which, again, totally fair. And it's interesting because it seemed like the Mac Studio was such a logical computer. Like, and I think that, to give Apple credit, the trend in the last few years has been making a lot of smarter decisions around the Mac. They're clearly listening to the feedback they got mid last decade about, you know, thin overheating laptops with no ports. And, you know, I think it's interesting that they're playing in the consumer monitor space again after getting out of it, because, you know, if this thing cost $1,000 and had all these, you know, nice features, great speakers, a built-in webcam, you know, the A13 in there, which might allow for some like fun trickery down the line, then it would be a lot more compelling of a product, because I wouldn't mind paying a bit of an Apple tax, but not a double-priced Apple tax.
I could see paying like $1,600 too, if like the potential of this thing's 8/13 processor was actually, you know, alive. People have noticed, there was one Twitter user who noticed that it has 64 gigabytes of storage in
there.
That's
pretty significant.
Like in the screen, because I think the way Apple just manufactures the A13s is like they probably have the storage. So it is cheaper just to keep building those chips or use the older chips rather than reorient their whole manufacturing process to get a 32 gigabyte, you know, storage or something even smaller in there. It just kind of makes sense. But that means like this thing is basically an iMac. Like it has storage, it has processing, it has like GPU circuitry. I could see a world where Apple had tried to make this like a smart display, right? Where if you didn't have any Mac attached to it, you could just like, you hit a button and you could do a FaceTime call, or you could AirPlay from any of your devices right to it, or you could just like do things with it, use it as like a speaker system, you know, wirelessly. And I could see that happening down the line, but maybe through hackers, not really through Apple itself. It is weird.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like the kind of thing they would necessarily enable, but it's really interesting that it's there. But your point about this basically being an iMac is really interesting, because the other thing I was going to mention is that at this price, $1,600, you could just straight up buy an iMac like with a slightly smaller screen, 24-inch screen, but it's a whole damn computer instead of just a monitor.
And right? I reviewed the new M1 iMac, and it's really nice. It's really thin. You can move it around more easily. The iMac is actually thinner than this monitor, you know, which is just a monitor. They also killed the 27-inch iMac as well. So
I'm surprisingly bummed about that, because I feel like that was, again, a sweet spot. The display size is nice. If you want something a little bigger, the 24-inch, I have a 24-inch monitor on my desk, and it feels like a little smaller than I'd like. All this monitor discussion is definitely making me want to buy something nice and new. It won't be this Apple display.
One thing I haven't mentioned is that this is a pixel perfect Apple screen. So like, because of the way macOS scales the resolutions and everything, like having a 5K screen from Apple means like everything shows up the way it's supposed to. Whereas if you were to plug into like a 4K monitor into your Mac, like there are some issues there. Like, you have less usable desktop space. You couldn't, like, view a full 4K video while also viewing some of your timeline, which you can't do in a 5K monitor. So there are certain things that Mac heads, and I will... I guess I'm a PC guy, or I'm like I'm a platform agnostic guy too, because I have to use both. I have to review both, and I have issues with the PC side of things. I love like Apple's ability to like combine hardware and software, but I have, I think, more issues with Apple's like just what they do and what they force upon their users. And there aren't many other choices, right? You have, there is the LG Ultrafine 5K monitor, which came out several years ago. Everybody hates it because it's like a piece of junk. It's like built, it's cheap plastic. They fall apart. Everybody who's bought one, like I've seen, have talked about like having to return them or get them repaired. So
how's the panel on that though, compared to like this one?
I mean, I don't know about compared to this one. I hear the LG panel was pretty much the same as the one on the iMac. So probably pretty similar, but you know, you're not getting a nice metal case and all the other like Apple niceties. And that's a weird thing. It's just, It is confounding to me. I wish there were more options. I wish the pricing was more fair. I wish Apple treated their consumers better. But that's just me. But Nate, you reviewed the iPad Air. And I feel like that is a device where it's like, okay, I see what Apple's doing here. It's actually much better and much more consumer friendly in many ways, right?
And I'm going to pull Steve Jobs and be like, I happen to have it right here.
Yay.
yeah, it is a great tablet. So first of all, though, you kind of have to say like, do I like using an iPad for starters? If you don't care about tablets, then obviously it's not for you. The software hasn't changed in a significant way to make you say, oh, like maybe I'll, you know, use this as a desktop or laptop replacement now. You certainly can. I've had an iPad Pro 11 inch for almost 2 years now, and I can do most of my job on it. But I mostly like it as like a couch computing device is kind of how I put it, like a casual after work, browse the web, do my emails. It's great for when you travel for videos and music and reading and that sort of thing. And if you want to do more, that you certainly can, because the apps that most developers make for the iPad are still really, really good. But as for this Air specifically, it starts at $600 and it has an M1 processor in it. And that's pretty crazy if you ask me, considering that that chip is also in all of, it's in the iMac we just talked about. It's in the MacBook Air, it's in the 13-inch MacBook Pro, it's in the iPad Pro, and now it's in the iPad Air, which is by far the cheapest device out of all those that have an M1.
They only added it to the iPad Pro like last fall too, right? So it wasn't that long ago. Right?
It was actually a year ago this spring. Okay. So it was exactly a year ago, yeah.
Gotcha. So this is a pretty big time. I think the Mac Mini gets to be like under this price, you know? So, but that is wild, right? The M1 chip is basically the M1 chip. Not much changes. So now they can like take that thing and stuff it in your tablet, put a screen on it. And do you notice any like speed improvements over like the previous gen iPad Air or other ones?
Yes. So like I said, I've got an 11-inch iPad Pro that doesn't have the M1. It has the A12Z.
So that's a 2019?
It's a 2020, but the A12Z is only a slight variant on the A12X, which was in the 2018 iPad. So it's getting like a little old. And the M1 benchmark-wise just smokes it, like on single core, multi-core, it's way faster. And in terms of actual use, you know, I was surprised to find like basic stuff, like just like using the Apple Mail app, like deleting all my email, just like snaps in a way that like my old iPad doesn't feel old, but it does now. So like things like that, you know, just like switching tabs, loading up browser tabs is super fast. Any app loading is super fast. I was using Lightroom to edit some like raw photos. I took review photos of it in our office, and then I imported them directly into the iPad, into Lightroom, using a USB-C camera dongle. And it, you know, uploaded them to the Adobe Creative Cloud, and then I had them on my Mac and everywhere else I needed them. But I did some editing on the iPad itself, and the edits are just like instantaneous. It's super fast. But I'd say that if you have the previous iPad Air, which came out in the fall of 2020 with the A14, you're not going to get quite the same, like surprisingly faster, you know, because that was already super fast too. The difference, though, is that I think with an M1, you can like buy this Air now and expect it to last 5 years, basically.
Yeah, the M1 is like a miracle chip. Like, go back to my reviews of like the MacBook Air and everything. Like, the amount of power in that thing was blowing away like all Intel and AMD chips at the time with no fan, like just astounding. Does your iPad Pro have ProMotion, Nate?
It does, yes. So that's one, that's like the big thing that's missing from the screen on this one. To be honest, though, I didn't end up missing it too much. I know people are really wild for high refresh rates. You said you got the iPhone 13 Pro, which has 120 hertz.
When I'm, yeah, 120 hertz ProMotion, and it's like I notice it when I'm scrolling Twitter and when I'm doing stuff. Like my eyes, it's just my eyes feel better because they are like being massaged by the screen rather than like having to like catch up with like the like hiccups between with a normal 60 hertz display basically.
Yeah. And I still notice it, but I was surprised at how quickly I stopped thinking about it on the iPad Air. So like I missed it at first, but I think honestly at this point that's about the only thing that's really separating the 11 inch Pro from the Air. And so it makes me wonder, I feel like either Apple will have to discontinue, they might discontinue the 11 inch iPad Pro altogether and just leave the Pro being the large screen device that it is, or they'll have to do something to differentiate it because it uses the same accessories, it's got essentially the same screen, it's got the exact same internal hardware.
Right. You could plug in the same keyboard attachment, right? Which is, I'm really intrigued by too. Like I want like a nice light writing machine where not much else is happening so I can just focus. So like, have you done that with your iPad Pro?
That's probably the thing I do with it the most. And that's what I wrote the whole iPad Air review on the iPad Air. I wrote the rest of those stuff I've been working on during that review time frame on it. It's really great to just like sit down, bang out, you know, 1,000 words without thinking about it. It's a lot easier to like go into single focus mode and ignore, you know, notifications because of the way multitasking works. You're not going to have like layers and layers of windows going. You'll just have your writing canvas and maybe like one other, like a Safari tab for research or whatnot. But yeah, it's really good for that sort of thing. It is tricky because, you know, the keyboard is great. It costs a mind-blowing
$300. $300. So, oh, my God.
And it's funny. It's the same problem we're talking about with the monitor, where, like, sometimes you'll see Apple do something that's, like, a pretty reasonable value, like an iPad Air with an M1 chip for $600, and then you have a keyboard that literally costs half as much as it. And, you know, or, like you'll have a monitor that costs the same as an iMac, and it's just...
Yeah. $30 or $50 more than that keyboard, you get the base iPad, and you could do a lot with that too. I've been eyeing a new iPad for a while. Like first, it was the iPad. Was it the new iPad Mini?
From last fall,
which is adorable and certainly very, very powerful. But this is like price wise, not that much of a difference. I think like I could carry around this easily. It would be more useful for like big screen comics and stuff, and having that keyboard attachment. But now I'm like, I really like ProMotion. I really like having that high refresh rate. So now it's like, do I just like suck it up and pay a little bit more to have a screen that that doesn't bother me as much?
That you'll actively love.
Yeah.
I think you'll actively be happy about it. And, you know, I'll say at this point, before this Apple event at the beginning of March, when people were talking about the new iPad, it was either going to be the Air or the iPad Pro. Since they refreshed the Mini and the base iPad in the fall. I expect that the iPad Pro will get an update at some point this year, but so it might be worth waiting for. But, you know, I'd say for like...
Just give me a discount on last year's. That's all I need.
Well, yeah. Go find a refurb, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. You
know, that's not a bad idea. They do have refurbished ones.
This is how I buy expensive hardware, is just go refurb, baby.
It's good.
The best way to go. And did you try Sidecar at all, Nate?
I did. So Sidecar is like, yeah, using it as an external display. And right now I'm actually using the new feature in iOS 15.4 and Mac OS 12.3, which is the continuity, or I guess I'm forgetting what it's exactly called, but it's where you can use one keyboard hooked up to your Mac and also use it on the iPad. So I'm doing that right now, where I've got my keyboard in front of me and my mouse in front of me, and I'm going back and forth between
Universal Control. That's what
Universal Control. Yeah. Thank you.
Which is, it's wild to me to see Apple just like implement this right now, because in like 2005, when I was working in IT, there were like several open source projects that were like, we could just sync up all your devices, Mac, PC. So I had like a lampshade iMac on my desk, and I had a PC to my right, and I was able to, with this thing, move one keyboard and mouse between them, and even do like some light copying and pasting, because like it there were like server access and everything. So like that was pretty wild, like, and to have that like almost 20 years ago at this point. My God. But to have that like actually finally natively built into something from Apple of all companies is kind of wild to me. Would you consider this, like, if you already have a MacBook of any kind, would you consider this to be like just the good accessory iPad because you can get Sidecar? You could. It's a lot lighter than even the MacBook Air, right? So, like, it's a good thing absolutely. To travel with in many ways. If you,
it's an ideal. And that's kind of one of the things I've liked about iPads since the beginning. Is like, it's a great travel device. Like, obviously, if we're going to a big trade show, we need our full setup. That's fine. You bring your laptop. But when I am, you know, traveling for myself, which I haven't done much of the last 2 years, but you know, hopefully someday again soon. It's a great kind of like little personal computer to have all my stuff on it, like my own personal stuff. I'm using, it's really cool, the universal control thing. Like, I've got a Bluetooth keyboard and a mouse hooked up to my laptop, and I'm just using them right now on my iPad. Although I will say, somebody on Twitter, I don't remember who, but they said that while universal control works really well, there's almost no situation in which it's better than just doing Sidecar, which is using the iPad as an external display. Because I'm like, okay, what do I have open on here? I've got like our show notes, and I've got Slack on my iPad, and I could have just had my Windows from my Mac over there doing the same thing. But
that's true. But maybe you want to handle an iPad app instead of, you know, a Mac app. Like, does Instagram have an iPad app yet? Is that the whole controversy?
They sure don't.
They sure don't. Something else that doesn't exist on Mac OS, but does exist on iPad OS. Netflix, maybe. Like,
yeah,
you can put it in a window, but yeah, there's no Mac Netflix app, so there you go. Who do you think this iPad is for, Nate? Because I really like the base iPad. That thing is super cheap, like, does like 85% of like what this computer does, and I think for most users that is just the one to get. But who needs the iPad Air, you think?
Yeah, it's really tricky, because I agree with you about the base iPad being like a super good value. Obviously, for $330,
if you've never had an iPad before, just get that. Like, yeah, you will be very happy.
Yeah. I reviewed that one last fall. I was able to, again, do most of what I do on the iPad Air, my iPad Pro, with that device. It just doesn't feel as nice. It feels old.
The keyboard accessory does not work on that, right? They have something
not that there's a second keyboard. It doesn't have a trackpad. So this keyboard that I'm using has a trackpad, which makes a huge difference in how much work I'm able to get done on it. If I'm editing text documents and whatnot, it's much easier to use a trackpad than keep on poking the screen. But it does have a keyboard case, which is like still pretty pleasant to type on.
I know Logitech makes a couple too. So
yeah, they do. Options, and I think Logitech makes one with a trackpad, I believe. This is for people who, like me, like Apple stuff, are willing to pay a little more for nicer performance, better hardware design, you know, not this kind of like old stale design. And it's definitely more future proof, right? Like, this thing will remain nice and fast much longer than the basic iPad. It's the one that I would recommend most people get, assuming that they can afford it. And again, it's not an insignificant price difference, more than $200 between them. But I'd say that if you are interested in using it for anything more than like sitting on the couch and kind of browsing, messaging, if you want to like get into more like creative applications, that sort of thing, then this is a good upgrade to get.
Gotcha. Like a good laptop replacement if you have like something else at home, maybe like if you have a desktop or something. So, hey, right. If you want to be creative, check out the iPad Air. Thank you so much, Nate. Let's move on to some other news. And a weird thing happened this week. Several weird things, actually. Snap, the company behind Snapchat, bought a brain-computer interface startup called NextMind. Have you played around with any of the brain interface stuff, Nate, at all?
No, I haven't. This is foreign territory for me. It's interesting. And at the same time, I'm like, what are they going for at this point? I think it's probably a very forward-looking acquisition, to some degree, right? Because this is not really like common consumer tech yet.
It's not. I mean, we've only seen like demos of this stuff. Looks like NextMind's thing looks like a headband that straps around your head. And, you know, the whole idea is that you can just think about something and it can track your brain synapses to like control a mouse pointer or just like make selections on a screen. Certainly for Snap's AR glasses. It could be interesting, don't you think?
Yeah, except that the only thing that I'm thinking about is that I think the spectacles thus far have all been like pretty like standard looking glasses, right? And this like would have to require more or more obtrusive hardware would be my guess. So again, like this might not be the kind of thing we're going to see like imminently, but yeah, it feels like the kind of like the acquisition where they're going to like use the tech and like bring the people on board to like do something interesting rather than just like start offering this as something in the short term.
Yeah. It just seems like they have a lot of money and they can start experimenting with this stuff. And really, I think everyone's like, okay, we have some technology. The race for the perfect AR glasses is pretty much on. Like, we know Apple's working on something. Facebook is being very loud about this stuff too. And Snap has produced, you know, they've been producing glasses hardware for a while. I've not been a huge fan of them, but they exist and everyone's exploring this. So even if it was like a slight wraparound glasses or something, or if it could use like the arms to like detect some brain interface stuff, that would be kind of interesting. But then I'd be really worried about like, okay, what are you tracking? What other information are you getting from me?
Yeah. I'd be more inclined to like, let Snap do this than Facebook personally or than Meta. But, and I like the fact that Snap is like being very experimental as a company in this regard. Like they could have just kind of been content to be like a social app that was pretty popular, but they're sort of pushing for something different. And whether or not it turns into anything, obviously TBD, but acquisitions like this like are pretty interesting.
I don't really hear people talking about Snapchat like all that much anymore either. Like with the rise of TikTok and everything, like I cannot remember the last time somebody has even referenced Snapchat next to me.
Yeah, that's fair. I feel like it probably still has like a relatively loyal like installed base. Like I imagine if your social circle uses it a lot, then you're kind of like not locked in, but you're going to be more inclined to keep using it, right? But I don't know. Although I feel like, you know, we track their financials and their earnings and, you know, when they report users, and I feel like they've still managed to keep growing a little bit. Don't quote me on that for sure, but they're not by any means dead as a social platform. But indeed, with like the rise of TikTok, there's certainly like a second tier thing.
It's like it is a very different thing too. Ben is pointing out in our chat that high schoolers still love it, and sure, I'm sure. I just like among the high school people I know, like nobody's really talking about or excited about the buzz on Snapchat either. Which
how
is
many
what I'm
high
saying.
Schoolers do you know?
I know I have family, unfortunately. Fair. Like okay. I have family all around, so I end up talking about like, you know, what kind of tech are you using? What social networks are you guys into? Stuff like that. Do you think, Nate, like, is this something, these sorts of experiments, are these like investor pushes from Snap, or is this like the leadership? Like, I don't think investors want to experiment like normally.
No, but there's also at the same time, like, they have to like, there's some like keeping up with the Joneses to this, right? Like Metaverse is a thing now. And so they've got to have their own, you know, play for this, right? So I could see it coming a little bit from that angle, but no, I think it's like been in their DNA to just like do some kind of weird product experimentation like this. And they've, like you said, they've been doing AR for a bit already, so this is like a logical next step to some degree.
Yeah, I remember when the first spectacles were announced, we were like, what the hell is this? And like, you could only buy it in like weird random pop-ups, and like that was a smart move just in terms of like buzz, you know, because nobody was really doing that.
I think in setting expectations too, in terms of like what it's supposed to be.
Absolutely. Another weird thing that happened this week, Apple apparently bought a UK credit startup called Credit Kudos. And this is just kind of a weird story to me because this has nothing really to do with the consumer side of things. I hear from what I've read, Credit Kudos, it's an open banking startup that exists to help lenders make better decisions. So basically, to help Apple better to figure out like how financing will work for a particular person. That's according to the blockcrypto.com. Yeah, I could see that being useful. You know, like it's when I was a freelancer, right, and I certainly didn't have enough money to just buy a MacBook or something. The point where I could be like, okay, I can just get this MacBook Air. It was like the 2012 MacBook Air, and I can finance it, and I can afford the monthly fees. It was like 0% APR. I really appreciated how smooth that process was from Apple compared to like most other companies. Like, it wasn't really like I'm buying a credit card. I'm joining the Best Buy credit card or something. Like, it was a pretty simple loan process. Certainly, I feel like if Apple can better figure out if they're like okay to manage a loan or something and do that quicker, that helps Apple sell more stuff, and that helps like more people like get access to their hardware. So maybe that's a good thing. Thoughts, Nate?
Yeah, your point about how you financed something 10 years ago is super relevant, because that's basically what they're doing with the Apple Card now. Like, if you want to finance Apple hardware now, they let you for 0%. You just do it with an Apple Card. And so, like, this seems like it would definitely play right into that in terms of, like, I think I saw either in our article or the one you referenced that I don't believe the Apple Card is launched in the UK yet, and they're saying this could be something that plays into it, right? So, yeah, I think if they used to do, like, I know for a while there was a Barclays MasterCard that they used for financing, same deal, 0% over a, you know, 6, 12, 24 months, depending on how much the purchase was. Pretty simple. Obviously, doing it with Apple Card is simpler and gets you into their ecosystem there. So I think anything they want to do to, like, make that more sticky is certainly relevant here. But yeah, it is definitely a weird you know, acquisition. We don't hear about them buying like banking startups.
We don't really hear about their acquisitions at all. Like, it's very like every time Apple acquires a company, and when I've had to like report on this, it is a lot of like begging Apple, like, hey, is this a thing? Is this real? And then Apple will never say anything. And I think the confirmation here is that Credit Kudo's website points to like Apple terms of use at some point. So that's kind of the big tell there. What do you think about the Apple Card? Nate, like, I have not signed up for it, but it is an intriguing idea.
Credit cards are tough. I've just been recently trying to decide like what I wanted to use for a credit card, because I was like, I want something that gets me better travel points. You know, like, I'm like, again, like, I want to go on vacation finally. So I had an Amazon card or Amazon Prime card, and I'm trying to get off of Amazon. So, you know, once I'm not a Prime subscriber, that card won't be very useful. So, you know, again, moving off of that.
I forgot they had a Prime card. Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. You get like 5% cash. You get 5% on Amazon purchases, which is like pretty good, but I don't want to be spending most of my money on Amazon anymore. So it's not.
Yeah.
So, the Apple one is good because I think you get 2% anywhere you use Apple Pay. And then 3% at Apple and like a bunch of other places. So like it's very simple. You know, that's again, it is very Apple in that like you don't have to think about it too much. You get, you know, just straight cash refunds to your card, which is nice. And I think it like builds, it makes the wallet even more useful. Although, you know, I think once you like, do you use Apple Pay? Like, do you have your credit cards?
I use it everywhere. Like Apple Pay is like super helpful, especially now when I don't want to like fish through my wallet. So around here, where I am in Georgia, like almost everywhere it takes Apple Pay for everything. And also PSA for everybody, never swipe your credit card at a gas station. There is like a goddamn pandemic going on out there. Another pandemic of skimmers everywhere.
Really?
And this is a story maybe to like dig into at some point, but I think gas station owners are like doing it themselves, because there are like phantom charges that I've noticed in my area that go to other gas stations locally. So it's like, I paid $15 for gas. I remember paying that a week ago. But if they charge you a week or two later, you probably won't even notice it, because you're like, yeah, I bought gas at some point. The only safe way to buy gas now, or really anything, is never swipe. You could use a chip reader. That's, I believe, harder to actually steal. But if you can tap anywhere, the safest way to do any transaction. Just a big PSA, because last time, every time something goes wrong, right, your credit card company basically says, hey, we detected fraud. All your cards are gone. We close all your cards. We're going to send you
a
new one.
They immediately go into like full, which like I get, but at the same time, it's kind of like, oh, cool, now.
And they'll send you a new one a week later, you know, and then there's always this period where it's like, okay, I got to change all my accounts. I got to change all the stuff. Anyway, big deal. Tap to pay if you can, folks. It's the safest way. But yeah, you had a broader point, Nate, about Apple Pay.
Oh boy, who knows what it was?
I don't know.
I mean, I think I think what I was going to say is that using like the Apple Pay, like with any card you want, be it a debit card or like another credit card besides the Apple Card is really great. And so like the Apple Card like has some stuff that is nicer than that. But I think for the most part, like it's really mostly worth considering if you want to finance a purchase from them. Like that's kind of like where they're really pushing it now.
And they're still doing separate financing too, right? Like if you don't want to get the Apple Card, nope. They're not?
I don't think so. I'm 99% sure they discontinued whatever they used to use. And now it's just like, if you want to finance something, you do it through an Apple Card.
Okay, yeah. That makes sense.
Here's the monthly payment for 24 months or 12 months or whatever it is. And
yeah. I don't want to promote debt culture and whatnot. It is hard to get anything financed. But if you're just starting out or you cannot like outlay all that money right away, 0% financing for something is perfectly doable. And, nothing to be ashamed of doing.
It's just when you get too many of those things going and it feels like subscriptions, right? Like you've got too many.
Be careful. I think what I tend to do is like, okay, I've paid off this one thing, like an exercise machine or something. It's like, okay, we needed that. And now it's like, okay, I could do something else or just like start saving that money. Anyway, moving on to our wild story of the week. And I don't know if the story has been changed at all. Have you seen the crazy Tesla jumping video from LA, Nate?
I watched it and it's really kind of ridiculous. I feel like this story is like the perfect intersection of everything that's horrible about like the internet and like internet culture and Tesla all like rolled into one kind of gross sandwich. Mm-hmm.
It's so the video went viral of like it was on TikTok. It was on a lot of other platforms of like just this Tesla flying over this intersection in LA, which is known for like if you go fast, like you'll probably get a little air. The person driving that car did not take into account the sheer power of an EV, like electric torque, which is insane if you floor it. And also the fact that Teslas are freaking heavy cars, like super heavy. So if you crash into anything, you're gone. Once you land, like from a big jump, like that thing is falling apart. So the video shows this, it shows somebody driving over an intersection, crashing into several cars down the street and just running away. They haven't really confirmed who the driver is, but the weird thing, the reason I'm mentioning this is because there was this also other weird thing happening where Dirty Dom, Dominicus Zeglitis, I remember seeing this online too. He admitted, it's like, oh yeah, it was me. And he showed footage of potentially him behind the wheel doing it. And, local news and stuff, like, got in touch with him, and, like, it was a big thing. Then he admitted in another video that it was all a prank, and he kind of staged it with his own Tesla and just, like, chopping up a video and, like, having friends, like, recreate the crowd, too.
So don't just believe everything you see, folks.
Just so wild. So his reveal video is just pretty, pretty crazy, and he certainly, like, I believe his TikTok account was banned. Once like that thing was admitted, but this is a weird social media guy who is like social media chaser who is like doing this thing to get the clout that being so infamous would certainly get you. And also Alex Choi, another YouTuber who like apparently he posted a video of the crash. I think the news is that he helped arrange like people meeting up there to film that or something. He is related to this as well. We don't know what that person was thinking. So I there's a lot of things I love about like the open nature of YouTube and online social media, like and how it's like made creators out of everybody. But there is so much like weird, like, hey, look at this crazy stunt we're doing. When I first started doing when I first started watching TikToks, a lot of people would just do like pranks on other people, which seemed like increasingly dangerous, and making people's lives hell because you get a little bit of social media juice. That part of all this is really annoying to me. But yeah, I feel like watching this whole story, I'm spiraling a bit, Nate. what is your thought at this point?
My thought is, like I said, is that this is like this intersection of... It's encouraging people's worst instincts, like you mentioned, like the TikTok kind of pranking thing. And then, like, I'm just trying to imagine why you'd look at this video and say, like, I think I'm going to take credit for this, like, destructive thing. And, like, I get it. Like, yeah, like, maybe people will be like, oh, my God, look at what this guy did. But, like, did he not think, like, law enforcement was going to not come knocking on the door, for example? Like, oh, no, it wasn't me now. Like, okay. Like, it's just...
It's not that hard to track to as a rented Tesla. So they're like immediately going to the person who rented it and being like, hey, so what's up here? Yeah.
Seems like somebody probably stole, like ultimately what seems like probably happened is someone stole it. I'd have to guess.
I don't know. I don't I think the wilder thing is that somebody now like rented this thing and legit just wanted social media clout for doing this jump and did not realize like how crazy
it was going to destroy the car,
how crazy it is. And there is like a GoFundMe campaign for somebody whose car was destroyed as well, somebody's Subaru. So like to see people get together to try to help that person, because who knows how much insurance is actually going to cover. Do we need a new insurance item for like
to cover social, TikTok stunts?
Social media damage? Like damage in the event of social media,
acts of social media violence.
Let us know what you think about the story, folks. podcast@engadget.com.
Don't try it at home.
Don't try it at home. We want to do a quick Ask Engadget section with a question from Ben. Once again, we're helping Ben Elman, our producer, figure out a computer purchase, but this one is for family, right?
Yes, this is for family. This is not just for me.
But you are basically just using us as like as a personal like advice.
Hey, no,
right?
Okay.
This is what I live for.
Well, yeah, but last week they were cyberbullying me into getting a new computer when I already planned on getting a new computer. It just wasn't fast enough for them.
Yeah. Have you gotten the new computer yet, Ben?
I have not ordered it yet because I'm pretty
Let
sure
the cyberbullying commence.
Oh, God. Come
until
on.
You, get you get it.
What'd you get?
A 16-inch MacBook Pro. Let's get to this actual thing. So the story is that I am staying with relatives, my uncle and his wife. They're about to sell their house here in Florida. They're going to be using the money that they get from this sale to buy a smaller home base, and then they're going to take to the road for months at a time with retiree trailer life. We were talking about like what they needed to do to outfit their situation. They have gotten their dream trailer already, but they asked me, like, can you help us with figuring out a important tech issue? They want a laptop that will work anywhere, so it can connect to cell service when it needs to. It can connect to Wi-Fi at like truck stops or campgrounds when it needs to. It might even be able to be a hotspot for other devices if they need to connect to the internet. So is there something that can do that? They like the idea of it being one box. So just like one laptop. They can do video calls, directions, email, paying bills, streaming, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. You know, we have spent years like charting the rise of like cellular equipped laptops. There was a big push from Qualcomm to make like, you know, that a big thing on Windows, and like a lot of it just never happened. But from what I can see right now, the 2022 HP Spectre X360, I just reviewed the 14-inch model of that. There is a 16-inch version of that computer, which is about as it's about as big as like a 15-inch laptop. Beautiful screen, great laptop. There is supposed to be a 5G version of that computer coming, so I would recommend that. That is like if you want a really nice looking machine,
but it's not out yet.
It's not out like right away. Dell's Latitude 9520, which is one of their newer business laptops, also has a 5G modem, I believe, like as an option that you could put in there. So it's typically like business-oriented notebooks that we're seeing getting this because people just want to work everywhere. And yes, you could certainly like turn it into hotspot, but then you gotta, that involves like, okay, you gotta do some Windows settings. Like you gotta know how to like share that internet connection, and you better hope it works properly. I will say that, those are two good options if you just like want one thing. But if you are really trying to live the mobile life, right, and you could maybe want to recreate like what you have at home, most of us have Wi-Fi routers at home, right? And through that Wi-Fi router, that is the gateway for all of your devices to get online and everything. And I think hotspots, and certainly 5G hotspots, are getting better. Like, the whole point of 5G really is to like, for a lot of people, replace home internet. And like the networks haven't fully gotten there yet, but I think T-Mobile has several 5G hotspots. Their coverage is really, really good too, because they have better mid-band coverage than some others. So you can be relatively certain that you would have some sort of coverage. It wouldn't always be 5G. It maybe sometimes would be LTE. But a hotspot would... Sure, you could connect any laptop to that, right? And you could connect your tablets to that, and you could connect any other device. Like, you may have other things in your home. You may have, like, a streaming, you know, you may have an Apple TV or something, a Roku device.
A Nintendo Switch.
To a TV, a Switch. Like, you have so many things. Sure, you could always just share it off of a computer, but that... that is kind of clunky. Like, computers aren't great at running sharing internet to multiple devices at once. And also, if your computer is the sole, like, cellular device in your RV, then if anything happens, like, if it stops working, if you have any issues, like, you got nothing. You've got no internet. So I feel like having combined functionality like that, it is a nice thing to have. If it's, like, on top of having a hotspot, sure. So then you could leave the RV and, like, just be online wherever. But I think for a lot of people, and I have thought about this too, get a good hotspot, pay the monthly fees for that, and I think you'd be a lot happier. And then it works the way you would. You just join your Wi-Fi network as you typically would. I don't know if any RVs have hotspots built in, but I do know, like, there are a lot of cars that have hotspots, you know, that you could just subscribe to as well. So that's an option.
I like the car hotspot idea. Obviously, you're not going to buy a car just for that.
It's rough.
But
yeah. It's confusing because, like, they're like, I have one right now in my Pacifica Hybrid, and it's like AT&T. So then I'd have to, you know, start an AT&T account. You have to hope it all, like, works. And then it's a whole other, it's basically you're paying for another phone service account, you know, and that's a whole thing. But if you were mobile, then maybe that would work out. Any thoughts, Nate, on this?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the hotspot is, like, definitely not something to be afraid of because it, you know, it limits. If you're trying to find something with 5G or LTE built in, like, you're really limiting your search for only a few good models. The ones you mentioned.
You could get a hotspot and a used old computer and be very, very happy too.
So. You could get a Chromebook
or one of your beloved Dell XPS models of the last couple of years.
Yeah, it seems like the way to go. Having some redundancy, like you said, having not just rely on that one thing, opens up. You know, you've got way more options there to find, like, the nice big screen video chat, movie watching laptop that you need. Don't be afraid of the hotspot.
It is the easiest thing to deal with. But also, if you want, like, a nice device with a cellular, like an iPad would actually be a lot more useful than a laptop, I think, with built-in cellular.
So talking about ease of use, you know, these are folks who have spent their lives in the kitchen. So they know a lot about culinary and not that much about computers. And so they are really focused on something that's really easy to use. That's, I think, why they are drawn to the idea of just having one box for everything. They use their Wi-Fi router at home. So that's is it as easy to reset as your at-home Wi-Fi router? Is it really just turn it off and on?
It's easier.
The only hard part is, like, you know, getting it set up with T-Mobile or whoever they end up going with. That's an annoying process. But yeah, beyond that, it's a little box that is spitting out, you know, cellular connectivity that you can connect to over Wi-Fi. If they know how to connect to Wi-Fi, it is as easy as it is at home. While you're driving, any device will have issues with cellular reception. So just be aware of that. Certainly, you know, be sure to download movies and stuff if you want to, like, be driving and also enjoying something, because you're going to have, like, reception issues as you're going through highways and under tunnels and stuff.
Okay, well, thank you so much, and I think my family will thank you also.
Thank you, and if you have a question, folks, we love answering questions here, so drop us an email at podcastengadget.com, and we'll do an Ask Engadget section just for you. Let's move on to what we've been working on. Nate, you said you had something quick you want to mention?
Yeah, I did. So earlier this week, Google officially announced that they're bringing Steam support to Chrome OS. So there's, like, a really early alpha of Steam running on specific Chromebooks. And I'm a Chrome nerd, and I also love Half-Life 2. So I'm like, I want to get this going. I think it's... I think it's a great idea if they can make it work.
There are a lot of Steam games that don't require hardcore graphics too. So
right, sure. There's, like, a lot of Linux support for Steam already, I believe, right? And that's basically what they're using here. And then there's the Proton compatibility layer, which I'm guessing is maybe not so good. But I've never tried that myself, using a Proton to run Windows games on Linux. But I like the idea that they're going to try it. So I'm going to try and get my hands on a Chromebook that runs this Steam Alpha and start playing around with it.
Just like the best Chromebooks right now? Like what is?
Yeah, it's a Chromebook with an i5 and I think 8 gigs of RAM is required. Google says that 7 models are supported right now. But it's like, again, I think they weren't, like, ready to actually announce this, but somebody at GDC was giving a talk from Google and they, like, kind of spilled the beans on it. And so they're like, all right, we're going to, make it a little more official. But yeah, it's early alpha. It's going to be janky. It's going to be buggy. But the list of games that they've tried and say that you should try, it's pretty long. It's like multiple dozens of games. Like The Witcher 3 is on there. If you have like the right hardware and run out the right graphic settings. So like, I don't know. It's interesting. I think that games is obviously one of the things that Chromebooks have been like totally unable to do. And now that there may be an option, like, I think it's kind of cool.
We have to do all this legwork just to have Chromebooks play like basic games. I mean, if you had a real laptop, you wouldn't have to worry about that.
I get it.
But yeah. You know, it is a cool thing. Game streaming on Chromebooks is something I've thought would be really interesting too, because if you have Xbox Game Pass, you could just like throw that in there and play your Xbox games from wherever.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, yeah, streaming stuff is great, but it'll be interesting to see.
Your big thing is you're looking for one of these Chromebooks, Nate?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've reviewed at least a couple of the ones that are supported, but I unfortunately do not have the hardware anymore, so I need to get one that I can try.
Okay, good luck with that.
Thanks.
Updates for me, I'm working on writing up a review with of the Halo TV series, which I'm still kind of mixed on. I think it does some cool things, but yeah.
Series started?
It is starting on Friday. It is starting on Friday. I've seen the first two episodes. I'm also writing up a gadget IRL, or, you know, a life experience with my Chrysler Pacifica 2018 hybrid. It started out being a very rosy story, and then Chrysler recalled the car, so now I can't charge the car, or the reason I bought that car. So it's going to be a conflicting account of owning that thing. Still nice car overall. So that'll probably be going up in the next few weeks, and I am just preparing to get out of here for a month or so to have a baby. That's a big job. That's a big thing I'm working on. Let's move on to our pop culture picks. Nate, I see what you have here, and I am not surprised.
Yes. Horizon Forbidden West. One of my favorite games of the last 10 years was Horizon Zero Dawn. I think that the story that they told there was just so fascinating. Really, really loved it. And so far, the sequel has not let me down at all. It looks wonderful. It's definitely one of the most gorgeous games I think you could play right now. I'm almost 60 hours into it. I'm not done yet. And it's great because there's the main quest sequence, which like, I want to know what's happening there, but it's one of those games where I fire it up and I'll start doing something and then just see something on the map or like out in the wilds and start to follow that. And just like, it picks up my curiosity and I go from there. And it reminds me a lot of Breath of the Wild in that way, where you might start out thinking you're going to do one thing and then go on a completely different journey. I just love it. It's one of my favorite games.
I'm glad you're digging it, Nate. I wish the timing of the release of these games were better, because the first one came out like right alongside Breath of the Wild. I'm like, I'm gonna play freaking Zelda. Like, I'm gonna spend hundreds of hours in Zelda. And I never really went back to the last one, to Zero Dawn. And I started this one, and then like Elden Ring came out, and so many other games came out. I'm like, I'm gonna be wandering around. You know?
Did you ever finish the first one?
I haven't finished it, but you know what? I'm like, I heard the plot was interesting, so I have seen some recaps. I know what happens. I think, okay, sure. Like, that is an interesting spin on a very familiar sci-fi story. So I think it's interesting. I think it looks great. Playing the first couple hours of this, I was like, you guys have not changed the controls at all. Like, Aloy still feels a little too big and clunky and stuff, but I'm intrigued. Like, once I have, if I ever have free time again in my life, I will probably go back into that. Right now, it's like the cosmic horrors of Elden Ring kind of have me hooked more. And I think I mentioned Tunic last week, which is on Game Pass right now. That is sort of like, I think you'd really like Tunic, Nate, because it's very like, it's a Zelda-like game where you're playing Fox with the sword. Nothing is like really, there's no like clarity about the world or how you do things. So it's a real sense of discovery game. And I'm finding that really interesting compared to like Horizon and a lot of other games too, where they're like, this is how you do everything. This is how you use the weapons. This is your class system. These are all the systems. We're going to spell it all out for you.
I will say that I think in Horizon, especially Forbidden West, the amount of like crafting and different weapons and armors and like play styles is much bigger than like their upgrade tree is huge, almost too big in my opinion, but you can really like, I think, find a way to play it that works for you. And it'd probably be totally different than the way someone else does. Like, I know somebody who says they mostly do melee, melee instead of arrows. And I'm like, you're crazy. But like, hey, like you do you.
That is a game built around arrows too. And like being far away from things. But okay. I like I wish the traps were more interesting. I played around with some of those in the first
game. I don't really
game.
Use the traps very much.
Yeah. It's a game with a lot of options, yeah.
I do want to try Tunic, though, so good call on that.
Tunic is good. Tunic is good. Like, Elden Ring is all, like, the world is terrible, and these giant gods are trying to kill you, and Tunic's like, oh, cute fox, kill it. Like, it's still, like, very hard, but, you know, it is a nice change of pace. Shout out to, by the way, picks for me, I also want to reiterate that Our Flag Means Death, the HBO pirate show, it's really good. It's in fact even better than the first couple episodes I talked about when last I mentioned it. I'm like, they're like two episodes away from the end now, so like the season came really quickly, and it's really funny, and it really matures within like 3 to 4 episodes. Like Rhys Darby is a gem, and then Taika Waititi playing the legendary pirate Blackbeard appears, and just like, he is so good. He is incredible in the show. So I'd watch Taika Waititi in anything, but you know, he is a co-creator of the show, co-producer, and he is just having a lot of fun in it. And it's also like, it's not a typical pirate story. It's about people like trying to learn to take care of each other and be emotionally mature and stuff. So it's very sweet, a lot of fun, a lot of like SNL comedy alum appearing in it too that I didn't expect. So it is real good. Check out Our Flag Means Death on HBO Max.
Is it a mini series or is it going to be an ongoing thing?
I don't know if it's ongoing, but it's a series. So the first season is going to be finishing up soon.
But it's not specifically just like one season, like some other things.
They'll probably keep going. Like they have enough setup and characters where this could last a few seasons. Also want to shout out the movie After Yang, my favorite movie from Sundance. It is now streaming on Showtime. So go check it out if you have Showtime. It is worth, I don't think it's on VOD yet. So it is worth like doing a Showtime trial or something. I loved it. We just reviewed it on my movie podcast, The Filmcast. So I think it's a beautiful movie and everybody should watch it. Check out my review over in Gadget as well. Thanks for joining us, folks. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Ellman. You can find me online at Devendra on Twitter, and I podcast about movies and TV at The Filmcast, thefilmcast.com. And where can we find you, Nate?
You can find me on Twitter at Nate Ingram. I tweet about stories I'm writing and other nonsense, and give me a follow if you want.
All right. And email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. Thanks, folks. We're out. Don't forget to stick around for our interview with Dan Erickson, the creator of Severance. Hey everyone, you probably have heard me talk about Severance from Apple TV Plus on this show before. I think it's excellent. It is the latest series that is mostly directed by Ben Stiller, and it's created by writer Dan Erickson. Now, you probably have not heard his name before. He actually doesn't have many other credits on IMDb, so this is actually a big first-time project for him. The show is sort of like a near-future office space where office workers can have their work lives and home lives kind of surgically separated. When they go into their office, that is the only reality they know, and their outside lives, or their outies as they're known, have no idea what's happening inside the office either. So it's a really cool thriller that's very sci-fi, and I think really, really apropos for this time when we're thinking about, you know, the nature of work-life balance. So here's my short chat with Dan Erickson. Dan Erickson, thank you so much for joining us on the Engadget podcast.
Hello.
I have to ask, it seems like just watching the first episode of Severance, I have a feeling like somewhere a job really hurt you, like in your psyche or something, and like left a deep mark. Can you tell us about that experience that inspired
you?
Severance? Yeah.
I mean, they all did. They all did. No, it's so funny. And I struggle with how to talk about this sometimes because I don't want to besmirch anybody, especially anybody who gave me money when I needed it. But yeah, it was the idea for this came when I was working at this place. It's a company in LA that like I had found the, you know, job just on Craigslist because I got here and had no money and sort of needed the first thing I could take. And it was a company that makes doors. It was just like a door company. And
that's a real Dunder Mifflin moment for you. Yeah.
It was very Dunder Mifflin. It was, or very Monsters, Inc. was the other thing. Like, people were like, oh, are there big conveyor belts of doors that you ride on? And I was like, yeah, of course. But no, it was a really nice, it was a nice group of people. And I was happy to be working because, like, there was a bad economy, as it seems there often is.
Sure.
And I was happy to be there, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. And I just like caught myself walking in one day and fantasizing like, God, if I could just cut out the next 8 hours, just snip them out of my life and be going home right now, like I would absolutely do that. And then just realize that's kind of a weird messed up thing to catch yourself wishing for. It was that, but then as I was writing it, I remained deeply unsuccessful for some time at a lot of jobs and was moving between these different office jobs, either temp jobs or just jobs that became temp because I wasn't very good at them. And I just sort of found myself, I was watching myself sort of become these slightly different people in each of these roles, depending on sort of what I thought was expected of me. And then, of course, you know, I also got, there's so much just delicious, weird corporate stuff that's real and that you find in any sort of corporate workplace you're going to be in. So I was able, as I was writing the pilot and developing the series, to sort of draw firsthand from a lot of that stuff.
Gotcha. I have to say, like, just watching the series, and I was watching it with my wife, we were like, this feels very Office Space, or at least like the Office Space of now, in terms of like how a lot of us are feeling about work, not just being trapped in cubicles, but it's a little more even existential. Did the pandemic sort of reshape your thoughts around work-life balance at all? Like, to kind of like, did it help solidify your vision, or was it all written before this started?
It was all written before it started, and we were 3 weeks away from shooting when the lockdowns hit. And it was just, you know, we left expecting to come back 2 weeks later, and then, you know, weeks turned to months, as we all remember. And I thought that they were just going to cancel the show. I was like, this is the universe wasn't going to let me have this. I found a way to make COVID about me, but I was also just worried that there was going to be no, I was like, we're creating an office show right as offices are going extinct, because there was, you know, it was clear that not all jobs were going to be coming back in the way that we knew them, and that a lot of things were going to sort of become remote. And so I was like, oh no, is this going to be the least relevant thing ever made? But what was fascinating was it changed the context, but it definitely didn't dampen the context, because I think that, you know, the fact that I believe you and I are in our homes right now, are both in our homes doing work, you know, it's insane that if anything, it made it harder to have a personal life. The fact that like we all had to go home and work followed us home.
Exactly. It almost seems like real life wrote the sequel for you, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
No, it totally did. It was, so it was a weird, like, we were figuring out as we went what kind of world we were going to be releasing this show into. And, you know, the fact that the pandemic, I think, springboarded us a little bit into this great resignation and this time where people are rethinking what is an appropriate work-life balance and what's an appropriate amount of yourself to give over to your employer, you know, in exchange for the privilege of living on this earth. You know, it's just there's a lot of fascinating questions being asked that I didn't know were going to be being asked, but it's a fascinating time to release this particular show.
Mm-hmm. I love the philosophical implications of how we like define ourselves, certainly in real life, but also the way you present it in the show. Is that something, you know, that you started thinking about after you had kind of the string of jobs, or have you always been like exploring philosophical questions like this?
I've always been terrified of work. I'll tell you that much.
I feel you. Yeah.
This show, there was a play I wrote in college called Convention, which had a lot of the early DNA that I think of what would become this show. it's not, it was a very different story with different characters, but it was like set in kind of a weird, existentially confusing office where like nobody quite knew what was going on. And that was, you know, I was a senior in college about to join this big scary thing called the workforce. And so I think it's always been something that's in my head. Cause it's just a strange thing. Like you're selling a piece of yourself, whatever your job is basically. And so I, yeah. And then just seeing over the years, like as I did work these different desk jobs, like just seeing how different everybody was. And in some cases, how willing they were to separate, you know, they might behave in a certain way at work because that's what's what they're called on to do. You know, they might fire 10 people one day and then have to figure out how to either leave that at work or take it home with them and live with it. And there is this weird sense of like, oh yeah, I did something today that hurt a lot of people or caused a lot of pain, but it's work, you know, it's not me, it's work. And it's just, that separation is just fascinating to me and something that I wanted to explore.
Gotcha. I mean, some colleagues of mine too have noticed like the actual setup and the way you guys designed the show is also very stage-like and play-like. Did your experience working on plays and I assume like other similar things in college, did that influence how you guys wanted to present the show?
Yeah, it did. And you know, we looked at a lot of, there were a ton of visual references, some of which were, you know, film, but so I was just talking to Jeremy Hindle, the set designer, and we're talking about like the movie Playtime and there's these other sort of weird absurdist movies that draw from theater. And so, and then, you know, the story itself is, you know, like No Exit was Waiting for Godot. These were all sort of references in the language and stuff. And so I think that there is a theatricality almost to the dialogue and to the characters. And so I think it almost couldn't help but feel, you know, that translated a little bit into the visual look of it too.
Gotcha. And I was also one reason I like immediately took notice of this show too, is that it was, you know, it's produced and partially directed by Ben Stiller. I have loved all of his movies, like even the ones people kind of rag on. Like I think Cable Guy is like a perfect little dark comedy.
Genius.
So good.
And like, wasn't all understood at the time, but I feel like now people get it.
Absolutely. Like, so he's done good stuff. I have not seen Escape at Dinamore yet, but I hear that's excellent. I'm just wondering, like, how did he influence the series? How did he like help you craft the story too?
I mean, he is, it's just, I can't overstate how awesome and hands-on and just detail oriented he is. Like I feel like because he's such a, you know, gifted comedic actor, you know, there are going to be people who always think of him that way. But to me, he's just like one of the best directors that's alive today in terms of like, he works so tirelessly with every department and getting every detail down. And it all has to be sort of working in symphony. And, you know, he has so much energy and would like meet with me for an hour and then go and meet with, you know, the costume department for an hour and the DP, you know, Jessica Gagne for an hour and then come back to me and be like, okay, here's what we're doing. And it's just the way his brain sort of, he has a great brain for sort of this particular language and the language of film and TV and just making something that works so of a piece. And yeah, I think that he was going to some really risky, daring places with this show, which he's done before, you know, stuff like Walter Mitty and Dan Amora. But I feel like on this show, it allowed him to flex so many muscles that we haven't seen from him yet. My hope is that, you know, people will continue to recognize Ben as one of the best, you know, one of the best directors out there because he absolutely is.
I should hope so. We're a tech site, so I do want to talk about some of the tech stuff in this show. And specifically, I love the old computers. I love the vibe of the, you know, the inside of the severed office, basically. Can you talk about like what was the, because it seems like this is a show taking place ostensibly in modern times, but in those offices, we have like 80s computers. What was the design decision? And, you know, what is the thought about making people use things like that too?
Yeah, there was a lot. Again, this goes back to Ben and his sense of visual storytelling. And because I always wanted there to be kind of a retro futurist vibe for the thing. And I imagined it as being kind of these older technologies kind of mixed together with newer stuff. Ben's question was always why, you know, his question is, okay, that's cool. But like, how do we ground this show in a logic? It can be an insane logic, but it needs to have a logic. And so, you know, we talked about the company as wanting to sort of intentionally disorient the workers in time and space. And there's a sense of you're in this just kind of soup of, you know, different decades and, you know, you can try to figure out where and when you are in the world, but you're not going to, because we're giving you all these sort of almost red herrings. So that, you know, you feel unmoored and you feel like your home is here. Your home is at your desk.
It's almost like a prison, but I'm thinking of like even my high school and some like school prison like environments that we were trapped in. It all feels very familiar. Well, you know what, Dan? Thank you so much for chatting with us, and good luck with the show. I hope we see a season 2. I'm looking forward to finishing the rest of this season.
Thank you so much. It's great talking to you, and I'm glad you're enjoying it.